You're listening to Trek FM.
Want to join in the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode? Join the Babel Conference, our listeners' discussion group on Facebook. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the Facebook search field, and we'll look forward to seeing you there.
This is Steve Sansweet of Rancho Obi-Wan, and you're listening to the 602 Club.
There was a little bar in Mill Valley where all the Starfleet trainees used to go.
The 602 Club.
You know it.
I was there more times than I can remember.
You did this.
Where is she? There he is. She didn't do this, Zach. You did.
Turning on each other. It's what they want. I tried to warn you, Charles. I want you by my side. We're brothers, you and I. All of us together, protecting each other. We want the same thing.
My friend, I'm sorry, but we do not.
Hello and welcome to the 602 Club, Trek FM's General Geek Show, coming at you from balmy Cuba. I've got to say, the beaches are fine and the cigars are fantastic, and there sure is a lot of submarine wreckage here on this beach. But I'm joined by none other than Sean Eastridge.
Matt, it is a pleasure to be here. The submarine wreckage, you know, I wasn't really feeling it before, but I think it adds some nice conflict to what could otherwise just be kind of a dull scenic view. Who wants that when you can have explosions, missile crises, whatever, all of the above. But I'm very happy to be here.
Well, you know, as long as the rum keeps flowing, I think we'll be fine. And so,
<I agree. laughs>
but we're going to be talking about X-Men First Class. We have skipped a few X-Men. We'll talk about that. But before we
wait,
dive
we're not
in,
talking about X-Men 3?
No, you
what?
Watched the wrong one.
Oh, no. Why would I do
Man,
that to myself?
I don't know.
It hurts in so many ways.
It's not even that it hurts so good. It just hurts. So, but you can find us all over the place. We're on iTunes at itunes.com/TrekFM. Make sure you check out the 602 Club there, as well as all the other Trek FM shows. And while you're there, do give us a star rating and review. Let people know what you think of the show and help them find the show with your star rating and review. You can follow us and like us all over the place. So follow us on Twitter at Trek FM, Facebook at facebook.com/TrekFM. You can find our listeners only discussion group on Facebook, which is called the Babel Conference. And if you type Babel into the search field on Facebook, that'll bring you over there. Or maybe you're on the website at trek.fm and you're just perusing around. If you hit discussion on any of those mini bars you've got on our show pages, it'll bring you over there as well. And you can talk to all the different people around the world talking about Trek FM shows. And last but not least, maybe you want to write an email. It's been a while since we've gotten one. So go to trekfm.contact, choose a show, choose the 602 Club. That email will come to me and then any of the hosts that are on that week, and we'll get the opportunity to converse with you that way. But as I mentioned, we are going to be talking about X-Men First Class, and we did skip some mutant history.
We did.
With X-Men 3 and Wolverine Origins, which, you know, it's interesting because both of those movies are, they're not very good films.
No, I would go so far as to say they're terrible films. X-Men 3, I will just go out on a limb and say this, obviously not the worst film ever made, but I think I may hate X-Men 3 more than any film I've seen ever. And a lot of it is being a film fan and really admiring what Bryan Singer did with X-Men 1 and 2 and how carefully he kind of layered the complexities of the characters, the subtext, the social commentary, very well shot. X-Men 3 is none of that. It's a kind of a rushed hack job, and I think I was so upset by it that it just kind of latched on as such a negative experience that to this day I consider it my least favorite film.
And you want to? Do you want to know something that will probably make you throw up in your mouth just a little bit?
I mean, it's like a love-hate thing, but yes, I would love to
okay.
hear this.
Yeah. So, X-Men Last Stand and Wolverine Origins both made more money at the theater than this movie, Ugh. First class.
Gah.
So first class, just so everybody has an idea, adjusted for inflation, so we'll go there, made $168 million first class. Wolverine Origins is the next film, and that made over $223 million. And then Last Stand, adjusted for inflation, is actually the second highest grossing X-Men film ever, which is over $331 million. So the box office didn't agree with us, but, you know, no. I think,
to be fair, I think X-Men 3 was riding the wave that X-Men 2 provided. I think your general moviegoer is not going to know the difference between Bryan Singer and Brett Ratner until it's too late. And I think everyone was like, oh, it's... Exactly. I think everyone was like, oh, the Phoenix movie, it's going to be great. The X-Men 2 was so good. This one's got to be great. I think a lot of that had to do with that. But,
You know... everybody's favorite character is Wolverine, so Wolverine Origins
exactly.
is something we all want to see, right? We see it, and then we're like, oh, you know? And then what's interesting is that there's this whole process of what they're going to try and do next, and actually the film that was going to come out after those two and kind of hinged a little bit on Wolverine Origins' success was they were actually going to do a Magneto film.
That's right. I totally forgot about that because, like you said, yeah, they went in a completely different direction. But I remember there were talks of like it was going to be it was all going to be origin movies and we're going to do prequels for everything. Wow. Yeah. I forgot about that.
Well, and it was all about him surviving Auschwitz and everything. And David Goyer was going to direct, you know, which, you know, David Goyer
interesting.
Is great stuff, you know. And, obviously he would have a very close heart for that kind of source material as well.
Sure.
And so, you know, could have been really great, but, it never happened. You know, part of that was also the writer's strike that happened. So a lot of things went by the wayside and they ended up wrapping up some of their ideas for, the Magneto movie into First Class and creating this, you know, at the time it was going to be basically a reboot.
Yeah.
And so I just wanted to ask you, coming out of that, when they announced First Class, if you can remember, what did you think about this idea of, you know, we're going to go back in time and basically tell the origin story of all of these X-Men that we've known. And we're also going to recast, like, which, you know, is huge when you already are in love with, you know, Patrick Stewart as Professor X.
I remember when they announced it feeling almost a sense of relief because they announced very early on that Bryan Singer was going to be involved in some capacity. Even if he wasn't a director, they were like, he's involved with story, he's going to produce it, whatever. I was like, okay, if Singer's involved, I feel like I can rest assured that it'll be better than X-Men The Last Stand and Origins. And then when they announced Matthew Vaughn, I think, I can't remember, I mean, I'd seen Layer Cake and then Kick-Ass, I think, had just come out.
Yeah,
so
long before that.
Yeah, and I'm not a huge fan of Kick-Ass, but I thought it had style. I thought it was fun. So I knew, I was like, well, Matthew Vaughn, that's a solid choice for an X-Men movie. So I was like, oh, well, maybe this will get things back on track. I don't remember if I was wild about the prequel idea, but I was kind of like, set it in the 60s. That's kind of cool. So I was excited because it seemed like there were a lot of creative elements falling into place that I could get behind and that I could feel like, okay, maybe we're going to get things back on track with this.
Yeah, and I thought, you know, I remember at this point, you know, I was really paying attention to like the behind the scenes stuff that was going on, you know, and obviously had been quite let down by the last two X-Men movies that they had put out, like big time. And so the thought process of them, you know, kind of revamping and reorganizing into, you know, the first galactic, no, not empire, but the first mutant empire, you know, was a good idea to me. And two, you know, I mean, the idea of going back and kind of seeing the origins of how Charles and Eric end up on different sides.
Yeah, that was exciting.
Yeah. So, and I, you know, I think that's the thing that ends up working the best in the movie. I just, you know, rewatching it for, I would say, to me, the thing that really stood out the most was the story of those two guys and the way that they end up on opposite sides of the spectrum. And, you know, plus you cast some amazing people in it. It just, this creates a mutant history to where I'm, after the movie, I'm excited then to, okay, where do we go next?
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I think McAvoy and Fassbender is inspired casting, and they really, really make this movie. I think First Class is teetering on the edge of being good and being kind of meh, and what really keeps it on the edge of the line that favors being good is their performances, as far as I'm concerned. And a lot of their scenes together, their moments together, are, I think, the highlights of the film. And it was tough because I think X-Men First Class is a movie that tries to do a lot in one movie. It felt like they were rushing at points because they were not Matt rushing, just rushing. And they were just trying to get, like, we need to have this, and we need to make sure that he gets paralyzed, and we need to make sure that mm-hmm. they're enemies now. So I almost was wishing, and then when we get to Days of Future Past, I know we're not talking about that, but it feels like they kind of took a few steps back and tried to put them back in some other places. They kind of retconned a little bit of this movie, but it felt like their relationship got a little too rushed, and I wanted more of it. I wanted it to breathe a little bit before we got to the end where he's like, okay, now I'm evil now, and everything, we are now enemies. It was a little like, oh, but I want more. I want to see this development. I want, you know, you can let it breathe, let it play out over a couple movies. I think maybe part of it was they weren't sure if they were going to get to do more of them. So they were like, let's just wrap it up so we can have it tie right into the first X-Men if it needs to.
Yep. Well, and I mean, you know, I look at the box office receipts here, and you're definitely wondering if you're going to get any more mutant history, I think, when yeah. you see that this doesn't do amazing at the box office. I mean, worldwide, it makes $353 million. So right. that's not bad. But, I mean, it's definitely not where the X-Men franchise was with, say, X2 and X3, which I think yeah. they were maybe hoping for.
And I think, so, I mean, you also consider the budget, which was, it says 140 to 160 million. You multiply that by two to consider marketing costs, and you're looking at a film that only made maybe a $30 to $50 million profit. It may have even just broken even, and it's funny because right. the Wikipedia page says, oh, it was a box office success, but was it? It doesn't look like it was. So to your point, I'm amazed that we got Days of Future Past, but also not surprised that it ended up saying, let's combine the old with the new, put Wolverine in there, let's get this together.
Well, it does seem like, you know, it's a box office success in the sense that it's well-received, you know, it gets good reviews, and I think you are kind of left, you know, wanting more, and I think the studio maybe senses that, even if the box office isn't as big as it could be. But I mean, in the end, you know, this is not, I just to put it in perspective, this is not a bad performance. You know, most films don't make $1 billion, so if you're making, you know, $350 million, it's a good deal. Plus, you have to, you know, you put in all of the costs, all of the earnings you get when you put it on a home release, too.
Mm.
You know, studios keep raking in money for years with that kind of stuff. So, you know, I think what they did is they create a foundation here to which they can build off of. And a part of that is, we mentioned just a second ago, was the new cast. And I think, you know, James McAvoy, my first time of seeing him was all the way back with Narnia. He plays Mr. Tumnus.
Oh, yeah, Mr. Tumnus.
He's so great in that role. And he just continues to build and build. But I felt like he, the way that Vaughn and the writer here create this arc for him of kind of being this a little bit too naive, you know, very hip 60s dude who really loves his powers because they help him get chicks, you know, into more of what we see, you know, what we know of Professor X.
Yeah.
You know, I think it's a really nice job, you know, without McAvoy as Professor X, I definitely think this movie would not be half of what it is because he really does draw you in.
I totally agree. He is, I love, it humanizes him because Professor X. We've seen him as the stoic teacher who can do no wrong, very wise. So to see him kind of in this sort of like, you know, youthful, kind of very energetic, very, it's just a fun character. And you get to see him develop. I think one of my favorite sequences in the film is watching him, the montage where he's teaching the kids how to hone their mm-hmm. powers and just him being in his element like that. And McAvoy really sells it. I mean, a lot of the dialogue in this film is a little cheesy and it's a little stilted at times, but there's not a single moment I don't believe him. And he does such a great job making every line work and making the character work completely. And you kind of really latch on to him right from the get-go. And it makes it very easy to enjoy the film and to really buy into this character and his relationships with everybody.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think you're right. You know, this movie in some ways reminds me of, you know, the Star Wars films in the sense that, you know, a good actor can make the not the best dialogue really work. And so, you know, whether it's the prequels and you know, Ewan McGregor just stealing the show with his delivery of the lines, or, you know, the original trilogy where, you know, Carrie Fisher and Mark Hamill and Harrison Ford are able to make something of the dialogue that may not be the best unless it's in somebody's hands that does something with it. I think that both him and, you know, Michael Fassbender really do something with this film, and they make it their own. And like you said, it's those moments when they're together, like, you know, the moment where they're training and he's tapping into his mind and they relive the moment of Sabbath with him and his mother. And Eric is crying, and then you look at Charles and he's crying, and it's just like, it's such a well-done scene, and in any other hands, it could be super cheese, but they make you feel the emotion of what's happening, and because they're such good actors.
Yeah, the sincerity is there, and you, I mean, that is easily one of my favorite moments in the film, because you feel that emotion so deeply, and their chemistry is so good, but it's a really beautiful moment. I wanted more of those moments in this movie. Mm-hmm. I think the movie is rushing so much to do. We got to do Cuban Missile Crisis. We have Sebastian Shaw. We have to introduce the young kids. We have to introduce the mansion. It's trying so much to do a ton of stuff. And then it still manages every so often to find these moments of emotion. And it's mm-hmm. with these two characters. I mean, they're the heart of the movie for sure. And yeah, that's a highlight for me, that scene.
Michael Fassbender is just great in whatever he does. But he really does own this role, and he connects with those early scenes, you know, in Auschwitz. You know, of course, we re-see the scene with the gate, you know, but then they expand on that.
It's interesting that they reshot that, but then for the most part, it's basically following the same exact template as X-Men 1. I mean, shot for shot, it's almost exactly the same.
Well, and the emotion of that kid and everything that happens there, he carries with him, you know, so as he's on his kind of almost like James Bond type mission, which is very much what this film feels like, is a James Bond film.
Oh, yeah.
And so he does a really great job, though, of portraying that guy who can be charming and deadly all at the same time. And just the pain that he carries around.
Yeah, the moment in the bar with those two guys where he has the knife, so and good. He's kind of like, you know, my parents were imprisoned. They were killed by pig farmers. And I can't remember what the other guy's occupation was, but it's so good. Yeah, exactly. It's played to perfection. And it's the scenes, the movie kicks off and it's a little jumbled because you're jumping around a lot. But those scenes really anchor it with like strong, you know, Fassbender's strong performance really, really pulls you along in those moments where you're very compelled by that stuff versus the actual plot of the movie. And you can see in those scenes where a Magneto solo movie might have gone and what it might have looked mm-hmm. like, because it's very clear that those are almost their own movie in a way. You're learning a lot about this character, but it isn't necessarily connected to the main plot.
I think you're absolutely right. There is a sense where that does feel, it could feel disconnected, but I do think that Fassbender brings the intensity from those scenes into everything else he does. So he helps make it feel connected to yes. the rest, you know? And again, that's what him and James McAvoy do for this film. And especially again, when you bring their scenes together, they sell everything that's happened to Fassbender, you know, and so it brings a cohesion that I don't think would be there if you didn't have these two actors helping bring that together with their performance. So
true, because some of the stuff, you know, one of my biggest complaints about this movie is, you know, in the first X-Men, I think in the montage where Professor X is taking Logan around the school and he explains how he knows Eric. I think he actually drops an age. He says, like, when I was 12 or 13, I met a young boy named Eric Linshear. And you realize this movie completely retcons that. It's like, it's a reboot, but it's also a prequel because they do specifically reference X-Men 1 and characters in the X-Men franchise, like Logan. When Mystique turns into her adult self, she's mm-hmm. Rebecca Romijn. So I think one of the great weaknesses of the film is that, because everything is sped through so quickly, that relationship could have suffered. And like you're saying, mm-hmm. it's the chemistry between the two actors where if you lose that, I don't think people would have bought it as much, because I wanted more of them together, and I wanted to feel like they had gone through a lot together. To have them, they meet very quickly. They are together very quickly. They're established as like, yes, we're the best of friends very quickly. But all this stuff is happening like in the span of months. And the idea mm-hmm. of Charles and Eric, their relationship has always felt like they've known each other for years. And I mean, obviously, at the point where we reach in X-Men 1, they have known each other for years. But before that, I thought they'd had like a really long, fruitful relationship. That's the biggest thing, I think, that keeps First Class away from really working for me. But McAvoy and Fassbender, I could watch, if the movie had just been the two of them playing chess, I think I would have loved it regardless.
Well, and,
you know?
And I would say that there is a, they give it more depth. And so when they're on the beach, you know, at the end, you know, and he's saying, you know, and he's got McTaggart, you know, and he's choking her, and McAvoy's like, no, this is your fault. And he lets her go. And he's like, I want you by my side. Like, there's such raw emotion. There's such this brotherhood. And I think it's something, you know, connects to earlier in the movie, which, you know, is that theme of not wanting to be alone. And I feel like Eric and Charles, they feel like mutants from another mother. and they feel connected, you know, and they feel like they could be really close. And it's the thing that, you know, makes Days of Future Past work so well, when they're like, all those years we spent fighting each other, we shouldn't have been, you know? So there is that sense that they want to be on the same side, but, you know, Eric won't let go of his anger and hate.
Right.
And so, you know, and Charles can't accept what it is that Eric wants.
It's an incredible example of a movie that the performance is what makes it. You know, it's like so many movies you see, it's like it's a combination of so many things, the writing, the direction, all that stuff. This is one movie where I'd say the writing is subpar, but because the performances are so strong, it really, you like you said, you believe it. And that scene where he's like, you know, we want the same thing. And Charles says, I'm sorry, we do not. You believe it and you believe the weight of it. And it's so much because of them. It's an incredible thing. I honestly can't think of other movies, many other movies, where that is the case, where you really are invested strictly because of the performance.
Yeah, and it's, I mean, it's what's fascinating, you know, I can't think of another movie except for maybe like Shawshank, where you have such a good chemistry between two guys, you know, like that isn't something else, you know. The only other movie I can really think of is maybe Good Will Hunting as well, you know. There are a few out there, but where it's just really the performances that carry you through and get you to that point. And so, speaking of performances, what did you think of our new Mystique with, you know, the up-and-coming at this point, Jennifer Lawrence?
Right. This is right before the Hunger Games really kicked her off. So this is the first time I think a lot of people had actually seen her, because I think she just won an art. No, she didn't win an Oscar, but she got nominated for Winter's Bone.
I believe you are correct.
So she, that was, I remember seeing her at the awards ceremonies and not knowing much about her. And then all of a sudden she's an X-Men and it was like, oh, she's good. And then the next year, all of a sudden it's Jennifer Lawrence and she's huge. But she was, I remember
J-Lo.
Exactly. And we're all, you know, obsessed and we can't get enough, but she's good in this movie. There's some tough, like I said, there's some tough stuff you've got to work with in this movie. Like the mutant and proud line still makes me wince. And it's said as a joke early on, but when they try to turn it into something meaningful for her, it just doesn't work. But I thought she was solid. And honestly, I keep forgetting she's in these movies. It's so funny. And it's very interesting to see her in this one specifically, because it is right before she was launched to stardom. And it feels like in Days of Future Past and Apocalypse, she's a little tuned out. In this one, she feels a little bit more invested. And I feel like maybe part of that is because she was like, I'm an Oscar-winning actress now. I don't need these movies. Whereas in this film, she is still kind of a rising star.
Yeah, I can't comment too much because I don't remember enough of... it's been a long time since, I mean, I remember Days of Future Past. I just don't remember her performance specifically.
Yeah.
And then, you know, it's been a while since I've seen Apocalypse. Maybe.
And it's hard to remember Apocalypse regardless.
You know, except for the Quicksilver scenes, which always are memorable.
Yes.
But, you know, here I feel like she does a great job of portraying the age that she's supposed to be. And I think that she does a very good job of portraying the character who isn't quite sure if she wants to be the person who will fit in or be on the outside, and what it is she truly wants in that, you know, which is, again, a very, you know, teenage type thing. And so I think she does a good job of doing that. And, you know, I think the scenes that maybe... she doesn't quite have down yet is probably the bedroom scene with Fassbender. Part of that is because
he's Fassbender and he's so good.
Well, but the CGI work, so I'm taken out of the scene because when she keeps flipping, you can really tell it's not really her in the bed. You know, like there's this especially when she's Rebecca Romijn, and it feels like a CGI version of Rebecca Romijn instead of the actual Rebecca Romijn. So I'm not sure if that was actually the case or not, but yeah, it just doesn't work the way I need it to. But the very next scene where she's challenging Charles, you know, where she's in her full form, and it's the first time we really see her for who she is, you know, what she looks like. She has no, you know, human clothes on at this point, and shocks him. That scene between them is much better. So I don't know completely what it is, but for the most part, I think she's good.
Yeah, I wonder if part of it is, you know, speaking of the scene with Fassbender, when he kind of doesn't seduce her, but all of a sudden there's a romantic angle with them, which, you know, obviously that is hinted at in Bryan Singer's films and the trilogy as a whole. But that, I don't know, it felt a little weird because they never quite make it clear what age everybody is. But Jennifer Lawrence and the rest of the kids are clearly like teenagers. They're clearly like students, whereas Charles and Eric feel like adults. So the fact that he seduces her feels weird, and it's not really fully established other than the scene where he's like, oh, you could use your full strength if you would just be in your normal form. But felt that might be part of what threw me off about that scene. Is it's a little like, this is creepy, and also it doesn't feel justified in the context of this movie alone.
Well, and the question I couldn't get as well was, do they actually sleep together, or does he just kiss her?
I think it's implied that they do.
Yeah. And so, I guess you could take it either way. So,
yeah. Because then she's very like, oh, we're in love now. And it's like, you're in love? What? What?
I don't know. Anyway, it's very, what I think you nailed something early on, and it's this part where the movie's kind of rushing. So it feels like that scene there and that kind of build up, that it needed more time. And I know this movie's about 2 hours and about 10 minutes long. Maybe about, you know, but I feel like this movie could probably be 220, and if you could give some of this stuff more time, it would be better.
Yeah.
But, you know, Jennifer Lawrence, pretty good. January Jones, you know, was just hitting it big with Mad Men, and I don't know, what's your Emma Frost take?
January Jones looks like she needs a nap, like... the whole time, everything she says is just like, yes, I think that this is it. And I'm like, oh my God, please, it's okay, we'll take a break between takes, take a nap, come back when you're ready. She seems very bored this entire movie, and I remember the first time I saw it, never really noticed it. Someone later on was like, was it just me, or does January Jones feel like she does not want to be in this movie? And from that point on, I've always unfortunately noticed it. But She's the only, in the entire cast, she's the biggest sore spot for me, where it felt like, you know, I haven't seen Mad Men, but I've heard great things about the show. I hear great things about her performance in it. This is a weird situation where, almost like Jennifer Lawrence, but Jennifer Lawrence at least has the charm, and she handles her, like you said, her more emotional scenes well. January Jones just feels there, and then feels very... asleep, and I just want to tell her it's okay to take a nap. You can, it's all right.
I mean, I know she's dressed like a Victoria's Secret angel, but maybe she was just needing a nap, you know.
They were like, you know, she's wearing this outfit that will distract sufficiently that people don't notice how tired she is.
See, that's the thing, like, they get the look right, but then and I feel like she fits the part physically, but then she doesn't inhabit any of the part mentally.
No, you know, that kind of mischievous, very powerful. Like,
yeah.
She's one of the most powerful telekinetics, right? And she, it reminds me a lot of Rogue in the trilogy, even though I really like Anna Paquin as that character, and I think she's good in the first two movies. It reminds me, it's very similar, where it's like, why have Rogue at all if you're not going to let her cut loose and do her thing? Emma Frost feels kind of the same way, where it's like, oh, she turns into diamonds, but... that's about it. And then Magneto breaks her diamond neck, and she can't do that anymore.
Apparently diamonds aren't a girl's best friend. So
diamonds aren't forever.
Yeah. No, they're not. We don't have to talk about her anymore, but Kevin Bacon.
Yeah. Kevin Bacon's, I remember when they announced that he was in this, it was like, why, Kevin, why are you here? Who are you? Why are you? I love me some Kevin Bacon. I love me some bacon just in general. Bacon is delicious. But Kevin Bacon felt a little awkward in the previews. I think he's okay in the movie, but there's never a point where I'm watching where I'm not like, Kevin Bacon, what are you doing here? Who decided Kevin Bacon needed to play this role? I feel like I'm being very negative towards Kevin Bacon. Again, I stress that I do like him, but it felt a little weird to have him in this movie.
You know, the part that I feel like he's actually good in the beginning of the movie. I liked him at Auschwitz. I thought that part he played really well. And then I think the main problem, it's not so much Kevin Bacon. I just have a problem with the character because I don't know enough about how he's manipulating everybody to understand how he gets whatever it is that he wants.
Sure. And what's motive? He's kind of like, oh, I want to make everybody mutants. I'll blow up everybody and radiation will run rampant and everyone will be a mutant. But like you said, there's a really good opening scene where he's kind of manipulating this kid and he's very like kind of like creepy, like in the way he sort of like he kills this boy's mother and then is very excited about like, yes, you're using your powers. There's a lot of layers to him in that scene. And then as the movie goes on, those layers are sort of stripped away and he becomes just kind of a like, yes, now there will be no one to stop us here in my evil submarine lair, where it's like very clearly inspired by James Bond, but it just doesn't work in this context. It feels very shallow. It feels very underdeveloped. And there's so many scenes where he's just sitting with Emma Frost and they're just kind of like, well, now that we've figured this out, the next step in my evil plan is to do this. And it's like, all right, thanks, guys. But he feels very, like you said, Kevin, he works in the role. It feels awkward because I don't know why Kevin Bacon's in the movie. But then the fact that they start him off so strong and then just turn him into kind of generic supervillain number 25.
Yeah, and I think, you know, you mentioned something that's really interesting. You know, they go back in this movie and they say that, you know, it's the atomic age that's really leading to mutation, not just evolution, but this atomic age, and that his plan is to basically nuke the world so that there will be more mutants and they will be able to survive and they will be the dominant species then on the planet. But I feel like it's something that's so kind of glossed over in the film that you know, I mean, it's there. Don't get me wrong. It is there. But I don't feel like they do a good enough job of trying to portray him as anything other than the, you know, the mustache twirling mutant, other than, you know, whereas you get Eric and you totally understand his point of view and why he, you know, turns against Charles at the end and why he doesn't want the same things. You know, I feel like if you had done that with Sebastian Shaw, it would have been much more beneficial to the audience to make him somebody that it's like he's the proto Magneto.
Yeah.
Rhymes.
That's kind of what, I mean, it seems like that's kind of what they were going for, to the point where he even has the helmet. This is the origin of Magneto's helmet, is Sebastian. But part of me wonders, and I want to know what you think of this too. Do you think the movie would have benefited if maybe Sebastian Shaw hadn't played such a prominent role and they'd focused more on Eric and Charles? Like, because it feels like, as we're talking, I'm realizing it, Sebastian Shaw is just kind of a plot device. And I feel like there was a need to tie each X-Men movie in this new prequel trilogy has this need to tie it into the decade it's associated with. So I think there was this driving like, oh, we need to have the Cuban Missile Crisis. We need to have that. And Sebastian Shaw is the plot device that will allow us to do that. But that, it's like the one plot line too many that I think keeps this movie from having the chance to breathe like the first two X-Men movies did. They really got a chance to develop their characters, their stories, and this one feels like just 50,000 different ideas thrown in at once. And I don't know, do you think, maybe not remove Sebastian entirely, but reduce his role a little bit so that it's more focused on Charles and Eric and somehow you make Eric's storyline more organically antagonistic? Because when he switches at the end and he's like, now I'm pure evil, it felt a little like, did I miss something?
I think what you could have done is you could have rewritten the scenes that he's in to make them more impactful, so they weren't so much of him and, you know, January Jones sitting there looking bored, waiting for something to happen. And give him a way to not just kind of monologue what he's going to do, but kind of make it part of, like, give, you know, really show, don't tell, you know, so find a way to show how he's manipulating these people and what he's got on them and how he's doing these things and why he's doing these things, so that those scenes feel more important when you're watching them, I think.
Yeah.
And you would really help the movie and his character too, because, you know, I get it's powerful when Eric says to him, you know, I agree with everything you said,
yes,
but you killed my mom, you
right.
know, and that's great. But I would have loved to have kind of known more about Sebastian Shaw character and exactly why he's come to think this, you know, instead of him always being the guy who's, I mean, he's literally been twirling his mustache since Auschwitz.
Right.
So, and it's like, that's a long time to be twirling this mustache. What is it that makes you tick and what is it that made you the way you are?
Yeah.
You know, I guess what I'm saying is we kind of expect more from these X-Men films to have better villains, because like Stryker was a better villain in the second movie.
I was going to say,
first movie has Eric as the villain. So
yeah,
you expect there to be more in these movies.
It's a similar thing to Stryker. Stryker wants to kill all the mutants, but it you know, it's very clear motivations and very organically tied into the plot of the film. It backs up the theme. It's all about the movie. Whereas this movie feels like a bunch of different movies shoved together, and Sebastian Shaw is just one of those movies. I think you're right. I think we know what he wants to do. We don't know why he wants to do it. He wants to dominate mutant kind because we are mutants and we will destroy humans, but that's not interesting. It's a shame, but I remember when First Class first came out, really, really liking it. And I think maybe we were willing to give elements like Shaw things that we can look at now and say, that doesn't really work. Maybe we were willing to give them a pass because this movie at the very least is competent, which was more than we could say for X-Men, The Last Stand, or Origins. So I remember part of me was like, First Class, this is amazing. This is great. And looking, you know, the more I watch it, the less I like it. But I think a lot of what worked about this movie was just the fact that it worked at all and wasn't terrible like those previous two movies.
Yeah. And I think, you know, a character that I liked in the movie, which was Nicholas Holt as Hank McCoy.
Yeah.
And I was a little bit disappointed in the rewatch that I don't feel like he got as much. I don't know. He's a little bit shortchanged, I think, in the movie. I like his character a lot. I like his interactions with Jennifer Lawrence, their discussion, what it is that they are talking about, you know, this whole idea of, you know, can we ever really fit in? You know, will we ever be accepted? All of that kind of stuff. And I think that's the thing that really got to me was his struggle. I think it's a really good struggle.
Yeah.
And he and
Mystique have a very, I mean, storylines mirror each other. Their character arcs are very, like, they're both the freaks. They're kind of the ones who aren't going to be able to fit in. Even if mutants are accepted, they're still, like, it's a really interesting argument. And I agree. I think he's shortchanged in a movie that's trying to do way too much. They throw in now we've got to turn him into the Beast, which I guess you would have to expect because people are going to go into that movie expecting him to do that. But it feels like yet another thing that it's like, did we really need that to happen in this movie? Couldn't it have waited for a sequel or something like that? These are things that are kind of cleaned up in Days of Future Past, so they don't hurt as much. But watching him when he injects, he's like, yes, I have this thing. And I was like, oh my God, this is just a completely new plot that's thrown in. Like, I'm going to inject myself and turn into the monster. It's been hinted at, but it just felt a little too much. And yeah, it would have been nice to just maybe focus. And it's the same problem I have with Apocalypse. I think it would have been nicer to maybe, you know, don't focus so much on the end of the world plot or the villain plot, but just focus on these kids, their relationships, how they're interacting with the world, how these things affect them, because that makes it personal and it gives it the emotional core it needs. And X-Men 1 and 2 did a really great job of that. And First Class has these shining beacon moments that are just so brief that you want more of it.
I think that I would say the problem with this is that it's trying to do every X-Men theme in one movie.
Yeah.
You know, like, they took all the relevant themes from the comics and tried to do all of them in this movie, and it's just too much because, you know, I think one of the things that I found really fascinating about this movie is it talking about circumstances and how the different circumstances to which we're raised in can help shape who we are. And so, specifically with Charles and Eric, you watch the different places that they are from and the things that have happened to them and how they have shaped who they are. So, you know, for Eric, he has become a weapon that was forged by Sebastian Shaw, and all it has done is feed his anger and his hate, whereas Charles has been able to live a relatively normal life and be able to find a way to maybe find his in, and not a his in, but just everybody's in that's a mutant into the rest of society. And so it very much becomes about the idea of your circumstances, how they can forge who you are, but that you're not just a product of your circumstances. You have a choice to be something different. And Eric can't make that choice to be, because he's kind of like Anakin. He cannot let go of the anger and hate of having his mother die. He's Anakin.
Right. Yeah. No, that's true. I think the movie would benefit if it had just kind of burrowed in and focused on that relationship, because that is the most interesting storyline here. That is the most interesting dynamic. Like you said, these two people coming from different backgrounds, very justifiable reasons for what they do. The most interesting thing about the movie is that dynamic. These two people are still able to find a common ground, but eventually have to go their separate ways despite their genuine love for each other. They can't do anything about it. Like, they are, one will always be from Auschwitz, will always have that in his past, and Charles will always have his kind of privileged upbringing. They have to accept, it's kind of heartbreaking. And the movie does make that moment work. But man, I wish it had honed in on that and really focused on it, because I wanted to see that growth really, and I wanted to feel like there was something significant being lost, because while the performances are great, at the end of the movie, I'm like, well, it's not that bad. You've only known this guy a few months, so he's not your best friend. You guys haven't really known each other that long. But, you know, compare that to, like, if they had met each other as kids, if they had known each other for years and years and years and had spent a significant chunk of their lives together, the moment where they have to part ways would have been so much more effective. And I wanted that from this movie, but, you know, you can't always get what you want.
But sometimes you get what you need.
It's true.
So one of the things in that, though, is, and I thought that this is the storyline that I really appreciated, too, is on top of their circumstances, you know, this becomes, and if you've seen Tomorrowland, that whole idea of what wolf will you feed, and Eric continually feeds the wolf of his anger and his hate, whereas Charles feeds himself what is, you know, good and pure and right, you know, and it really goes to show that what we allow ourselves to focus on, as the wise master Qui-Gon would say, your focus determines your reality. And so what Eric always focuses on is the pain in his life, but he never is able to grab onto what is good. And that's what I think made that moment so powerful between him and Charles, where he brings back that memory that his life hasn't been all hell. There has been some beauty in it. And the problem is that Eric doesn't hold on to the beauty. And he even says, I didn't even know that was still there. And so if he had allowed himself to stay with Charles, Charles could have helped him find those moments again that he had already, and then helped him create new moments. But he immediately just rejects it out of fear. And it's the same fear that he says that humans have of him. And he just keeps perpetuating that fear. And so there's this whole thing about, you know, what you feed is what's going to become reality. And Charles is the only one in the movie who is trying to change everybody's perception by showing that mutants and humans can be together, whereas humans and mutants, for the most part, seem to be saying, no, we want to fear each other, and then that means we just want to destroy each other. And so it's this just, it becomes this perpetual machine of, you know, fear and hate and anger, which, you know, we all know what Yoda had to say about that.
Yeah, and Charles is also, he's a nurturing personality. He cares about people. He wants the students to succeed, not just for a tool that can be used on the battlefield, but he wants them to succeed because he wants them to reach their full potential so they can be the best version of themselves that they can be. And Eric never quite gets that. It's kind of played off in a jokey way, which is great, with him, you know, shoving Banshee off the satellite and forcing him to learn the hard way. Effective, but not like Charles' kind of take on the whole thing, not his method, where he's kind of taking the time to talk with them, finding their strengths, encouraging them past their weaknesses, and letting them find their full potential. And it's a really great story. I think that friendship, that relationship, is one of the most dynamic and fascinating in all of comic books. And at the very least, I'm glad they got two really talented actors to portray it in this movie. It never ceases to move me, their scenes together. I think it really is a strong point for this film.
Well, and what's kind of great about it too is that there is this whole other theme of, you know, you are not alone. And that's what Charles tells Eric, you know, when he's trying to get him to stop holding on to the submarine. It's okay, you're not alone.
Right.
And that's what he's trying to do for everyone. And what's fascinating to me is that he had done the same thing for Raven, and yet she ends up rejecting that because he won't see her the way she wants to be seen, which is, I guess, basically to see her as sexy. but also, too, there's this sense for him where he hasn't completely gotten to the place where he believes that mutants should be able to be who they are and not hide who they are.
Yeah, it's a fatal flaw of his character, is that his undoing is basically he can't accept Raven for who she really is. And it's his biggest fault is he wants to be able to fit into society, but it's compromising a little bit. And Raven and Eric don't want to compromise. And you understand the attraction there and the reasoning behind why Raven would want to go with him, because Charles, that's something Charles will never understand. Charles will never be able to relate to her predicament. She cannot assume a normal form and not have people freak out. So it's very interesting. I mean, and again, it makes Charles more complex. He's not perfect. He's flawed. And it's his flaws that ultimately end up breaking his relationships with people.
Well, and it's interesting though too, because, you know, for him, he does want to be the person that helps people see that they're not alone and that they're something bigger than themselves. And what nobody seems to be willing to do is, like Raven or, you know, like Eric, is to stick with Charles and help him understand where they're coming from. And so I feel like that's the fatal flaw for those other characters, is that they're not willing to invest the time that Charles is willing to invest. And in some ways, I don't feel like they're willing to just open themselves up the way Charles is willing to either. And so by keeping themselves in this kind of selfish bubble and making it about them, they miss out on that opportunity.
And in some ways, I kind of get it. You know, it's tough to be in their position where they feel like they will always be outcasts. So I get the reasoning behind why it's like, you know what, we've tried and people aren't going to accept us, so screw it. You know, it's just the, you know, at a certain point you lose patience, at a certain point you lose hope, and you're like, hey, I tried and it's not going to work. It's what makes X-Men so interesting, is that the complexities of these characters go beyond, and what makes First Class so frustrating when it focuses on a plot that is so specifically like, I must blow up everybody. It's the fact that none of these characters are fully right and none of them are fully wrong. They're all layered. They all have complex ideas and points of view, and it makes it so much more interesting when you have to shove all these people together to work together.
So you're saying it's a mutant layer cake?
I think that's exactly what I think that's what Matthew Vaughn intended. It's a crossover between this franchise and the layer cake franchise that unfortunately only had one movie, but maybe someday.
What did you end up thinking? You know, we've talked around the whole idea of it being in the 60s and kind of playing into history. And how did that just, I guess, the production value and the decision to kind of insert mutants into something so important like the Cuban Missile Crisis, how did all that end up working for you?
Well, I think it's a really cool idea. I think that's a lot of fun. I love seeing the way you can kind of make it work in a real world environment. That's fun to me. And I, you know, the 60s vibe, very clearly Matthew Vaughn was going for kind of a James Bond, like classic Bond vibe that does come through. I think maybe it's the fact that the film tries to do too much that maybe it's just one layer too many. But I feel like the vibe, the production value, that kind of sense, it's a lot of fun. And, like I said, I would have liked to have seen more, a little less of the like big epic battles and fights and villains, and a little bit more of maybe the kids like trying to find their way in the world, trying to do some stuff, and then finding a way to tie it into the climax at the end on the beach. But it worked for me. I love that these movies are depicting different decades, even though it makes less and less sense as time goes on, because 40 years have gone by, or not 40, 20 years have gone by, and Charles and Eric still look like they're in their 30s and 40s, even though they would be well into their 50s and 60s.
They don't age like we do.
There you go. But no, I like it. I think it's a fun angle. It's a unique angle for the series that we hadn't seen before. So that worked for me.
Yeah, I think it, for the most part, you know, Matthew Vaughn definitely has an affinity for the 60s, and you can see that, obviously, with what he tries to do later with Kingsman.
Right.
Is to catch
the seeds
vibe.
Are planted in this movie for that.
Yeah, and so I think that part really works. I do absolutely agree that they are trying to fit in so many things that sometimes it should have been the less is more theory.
Mm.
And you needed to be able to whittle down these plot elements in ways that allowed you to feel like you had more, even though you had less. And each one of those plot elements needs that. Or you just needed to make the movie longer so you could allow those specific beats and things to be rewritten and new scenes to help fill in gaps that we've been talking about there. I absolutely think you could have done that if you just 15 more minutes, you know, you could have done that with this movie,
right.
And you really probably could have solved all the issues that we've talked about, really.
Yeah. Well, you think about the scene where all the kids are hanging out and they're showing off their powers, and it's like, oh, this is so much fun. And then literally, like, 5 minutes later, they're being killed. Like, Darwin is dead. You know, it's like these people we just met, we barely got to know, and now, like, Angel is betraying them. Oh no, she's leaving. But it's like you don't really feel the betrayal because it's like, I don't really know you. You guys have been together for about 10 minutes. You know, it's like,
right.
Things like that really emphasize that I feel like the focus of this film was in the wrong place. It's like those mm-hmm. relationships suffer. You don't feel the pain of like, oh, Darwin's dead because you've known him for about 10 minutes
right.
And he didn't really play a big part in what's going on.
Well, and I will say too, you know, the rest of the production, I do think that this movie suffers from some very uneven CGI work. It feels rushed in a lot of places, and it pulls you out of the a movie. At least it did to me when I was rewatching it. I was actually kind of shocked by how bad some of it looked. And it was kind of frustrating because it really does. The problem is this, is that it's when CGI is not consistent in a movie. So the moment it's not consistent, you're pulled out because your brain sees the inconsistency. If it's just consistent work, even if it's bad work, at least it helps, you know? And
right.
So,
yeah, it's all over the place. I mean, some of the, like, the Kevin Bacon stuff, Shaw's power, it's a cool effect, but then when you start to see his face, it just looks very fake. But the scene where Magneto lifts the submarine out of the water. That looks really great. But then you compare that to like Angel and Banshee flying around, and it's like, this looks a little awkward. Beast's face in some shots looks very CGI. Yeah, I remember thinking, even when I like first saw this movie and was like completely on board with it, I was like, this looks a little cheap, which is shocking considering it has such a big budget.
Well, and the other thing that I found was that I didn't like Henry Jackman's score here, which was disappointing because X2 had such a great score, and I just don't feel like his kind of like rhythmic driving symphonic work really, it didn't fit the time period. You know, I feel like this needed to be, it needed to feel like James Bond, you know, and it doesn't feel like a 1960s John Barry score, basically, and that's kind of hurting the movie, I think.
Yeah, and it's tough. You know, the movie is kind of caught between, like, is it a James Bond movie? Is it an X-Men movie? The goofiness of Bond is kind of prevalent in the villain plotline and the Cuban Missile Crisis stuff, but X-Men has always been so grounded that it just doesn't fit for me, and I think the score doesn't bother me that much. I think it's fine, but it definitely, I did miss Ottman's really great theme from X-Men 2. I was very happy that that came back in Days of Future Past, but First Class to me feels like it's clashing with a bunch of different identities and ideas, and it feels very solely a work of Matthew Vaughn's, but I don't know if necessarily all the elements mesh well in a cohesive way.
I think you've led us right into then, you know, some ratings, you know, and so I'm interested in all that we've talked about where we come down. So Mr. Sean Dorman, Eastridge, which is your last name?
It's Dorman. Let's just say Dorman from now on.
Yeah.
Sean Dorman.
But where do you think that you end up rating First Class?
It's tough. I don't dislike this movie, but I will say the first time I saw it, it was like a solid 4-star movie. But each time I watch it, it just feels more and more, the problems become more and more prevalent, and it becomes harder and harder for me to like it. I would probably say if we're doing a 5-star scale, maybe 2.5. So like right in the middle, like it's that 2.5 is really James McAvoy, Michael Fassbender, that really amazing relationship and their fantastic performances. It's fun, you know, it's absolutely an improvement over X-Men: The Last Stand and Origins, but the clunky plot, the underdeveloped villain, the kind of the dialogue at times is very cheesy. It's all over the place in terms of quality. I think that lack of consistency is what kind of makes it hard for me to really embrace it. So I would say 2.5 for me, it's right on the edge of me liking it or disliking it. I would say 2.5 bordering on 3.
Yeah, for me, I think the performances is what puts this over the top, you know. So if, you know, the issues that we've named, you know, aren't enough for me to dislike the movie, but they also don't make it where I used to be too at a 4-star movie. I think for me, this is really 3.5 stars. It's a good movie. It could have been a great movie, I think, with some rewrites in places. And, and this is the thing I was thinking. I think this section of the X-Men franchise would have really benefited from a 3-arc structure and then thinking 3 films at a time here. So create a trilogy to where it's all in the 60s and 70s. And so each film has a beginning and end to it, but they all connect together. So you don't feel like you have to do everything in this movie.
Yeah.
And I think if they had created that plan, you would have had a much better movie, and you would have alleviated some of the issues we had. Or, as we mentioned, you put 15 more minutes in here, you rewrite some things, you know, you jigger around the Sebastian Shaw storyline, you give James McAvoy and the rest of the mutant cast more to do together. I think it really helps, because I think, you know, as great as the training scene is, it does feel kind of rushed because they're up against the clock at that point, because there's a ship coming, you know, so they only got a week basically. And so, you know, you just feel like you always want more. And that's not necessarily a bad thing, but here I think it is a little bit of a detriment because you do realize that you're missing some stuff.
You're totally right. I think that is, I really do feel like they probably were like, we don't know if we're going to make another one in this world, in this kind of prequel world, so let's just make this tie right into X-Men, and that really hurts the movie. And again, like I was saying, Days of Future Past, you see them kind of retcon some stuff and kind of take them back a few paces. I think as a result of the fact that they kind of tied things up a little too neatly with this movie's ending.
Well, and I do think that part of the issues we see here is that Singer had been the sole purveyor of what was X-Men in the first two movies that made them so good, right?
Right.
And really, truly had an understanding of the characters and the world that he had created. Nobody else is quite able to get there. And this does a good job of setting up something really neat. But then, of course, he comes back and he does kind of go back to say, we're going to do what I want to do.
Right.
It's kind of what I think JJ is going to do with, episode 9. We're going to do what I want to do. And that's just kind of an issue that you can run into with franchise films. And X-Men, I think, I was thinking about this too. And this is just kind of one last random thought, but the X-Men films, one of the things I really appreciate about the Fox is that just because a film didn't do as great as they wanted to, maybe, they never stopped pursuing what their vision was. Mm. You look at the mess that WB has gotten themselves into, Warner Brothers, by just not continuing to pursue the vision that they started off with and just believing in it. Say what you will, but Fox believed in it, in its vision, and it kept going. X3, X-Men Last Stand makes a ton of money. X-Men Wolverine Origins makes a lot of money. So they kept pursuing that vision. They make this movie. It doesn't make a gazillion dollars, but they just keep pursuing their vision. So they don't stop. And I think, I give them credit for just continuing on to do what they think is the right thing to do.
Right.
Regardless. And I think that takes guts. So good on them as a studio for not just pulling the plug because one thing doesn't go their way.
First Class may be a reboot, but it's also very clearly tied into the same universe. Yeah. Almost like explicitly at points. We even get a Logan cameo in this movie. That's probably
which
the best part of the movie.
Yeah.
But I agree. It's kind of sad to think Disney may be pulling X-Men into its cinematic universe soon, which is exciting, but the X-Men is so expansive and it has such a huge cast of characters. I don't need it to be tied into Marvel's cinematic universe, and it also takes away from this kind of identity they've established for themselves. So it's with Dark Phoenix coming out, I hope it's good. I hope it's kind of a nice little send-off for this franchise, but I feel like we'll kind of lose something once, if that does end up going into the cinematic universe.
I 100% agree, and I personally just look to what Disney did with Spider-Man and think, they're just gonna Disneyify another and that's not what I want, because the one thing that Fox has always had too is that it had its own identity, and it wasn't afraid to have its own identity, and I think that's good. We don't need all superhero movies to be the same. We need diversity. Yes. Otherwise, it just gets boring. So, some random thoughts there at the end. But I'm really excited we got to talk about this one. I can't wait till a little bit later on the year where we'll get together and talk about Days of Future Past.
Oh, I'm so excited to watch that again.
Me
it's
too.
Been too long.
It has been too long. And I remember that being one of my favorite superhero movies of all time. Like on the list, it's up there. So, we'll be hitting that up. If you just want to go ahead and dive in and watch it, go ahead, hit the Rogue Cut up, because that's probably the one we'll end up talking about. Thank you, everybody, for joining us. Really want to say thank you to our great associate producers here through Patreon, Ken Tripp, Davis Grayson, and Daniel Noah. I really appreciate these guys for supporting the show and the network. This is a very large network, and there is just too much going on. And there's no way that we as the hosts can pay for this on our own. So we ask you to go to patreon.com/trekfm and see how you can be part of our team and support us. We've got some great contribution levels where we give even more perks back to you, or honestly, every little bit helps. So again, it's patreon.com/trekfm where you can be part of the Trek FM team, making sure that all of these great shows keep coming to you. Sean, great to have you back. This was so much fun to talk about. I can't wait to hear what people have to say over on Twitter and the Babel Conference. But if people want to catch up with you and yell at how wrong you were and how wrong we both were about First Class, which is all Twitter is for these days, where can they find you?
Well, nothing would delight me more if people would come to @YayShawnDoorman and yell at me there. And you can also find me on the Nerd Party Network on my podcast, Missing Frames, where I also will have opinions that will just infuriate the masses. We watch movies that we should have seen by this point in our lives, but for whatever reason have never gotten around to. But feel free to check that out on iTunes, Stitcher, wherever. Go for it.
Well, and you should, because some great hosts from this network have been in there. John Mills has been on there. You know, we've had
That's
others.
Right.
So definitely check that out. It's a lot of fun. You can find me over on Twitter, MattRushing02, and then I'm on Instagram under the same name. Here on the network, I also do The Orb with Chris Jones talking about Star Trek Deep Space Nine. And then I am on the Nerd Party Network with the aforementioned John Mills as we talk about Star Wars each and every week over on Aggressive Negotiations. It is the best Star Wars podcast you may or may not be listening to, so make sure you check it out. We've got Owl Post that I'm doing with Drea Kaufman as we talk about Harry Potter one chapter at a time. It's a blast. We're right in the middle of the Goblet of Fire, so it's the perfect time to catch up with us and enjoy listening as we're walking through the entire series. And last but not least, doing a show with my friend Courtney called Cinema Stories, and that is where we talk about films, but through the lens of faith. Thank you so much for joining us, and y'all come back next year.